Well, welcome back, and we're on the line with Jacob Pomrenke from Sabre. Jacob is the head of the Black Sox Scandal Research Committee. Jacob, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Vince.
You know, this is a big year, 2019, exactly 100 years after the 1919 infamous Black Sox scandal. And to note it and celebrate it and to also continue to advance the understanding of it, you have created a symposium in Chicago in late September, right? Tell us a little bit about the date and what you hope to do there.
Yes, so we are organizing a centennial symposium to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the 1919 World Series, still considered kind of the darkest hour in baseball history because of the Chicago White Sox players who fixed the World Series and were later banned for life by baseball's first commissioner, Judge Landis. And so at the Chicago History Museum on Saturday, September 28th, we are going to hold a symposium, and we're going to talk about kind of what we've learned about the scandal over the last 100 years. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, if you've read the book Eight Men Out or watched the movie, a lot of people don't realize that we've learned a lot since then. And the Black Sox scandal, we consider it a cold case, not a closed case. We're still learning so much about this story and about kind of how it has impacted baseball and really all of sports in the last 100 years. So we're going to gather at the Chicago History Museum, and we're going to talk about it and talk about a lot of the new evidence and the new information that we've learned over the last 100 years.
Well, that's great. And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was around 2007 when hundreds of documents related to the scandal were actually acquired and made public by the Chicago History Museum, right?
That's right. Yeah, I've been fortunate to go to the Chicago History Museum and examine a lot of the documents that they have. And it's really amazing what has come out really in the last decade plus about the Black Sox scandal and all the new documents that Elliot Asenoff, the author of Eight Men Out, had no access to when he wrote that book back in the 1960s. And so we've been able to uncover a lot of new evidence and new information about the scandal. You know, that he didn't have access to, and he wasn't able to utilize when he wrote that book. And so we've been able to kind of, you know, change our understanding of the story and enhance kind of our collective knowledge of what happened back in the 1919 World Series because of all this new evidence.
Yeah. Now, you said the book was written in the 60s, right? When was the movie adapted from the book?
The movie came out in 1988.
Okay. And how true is the movie to the book? In other words, how much did it incorporate the understanding that Asenoff wrote about, and also how much of it was fictionalized to make it more appealing and dramatic for a movie, as often can be the case?
Most of the Eight Men Out film did stick to what the book had said. Unfortunately, the source that it used was pretty flawed. The Eight Men Out book had a lot of errors in it that we know now, and some fictional characters that were kind of invented for dramatic effect. And the movie itself added a few other fictions. And so, unfortunately, you know, what we know now about the story, about the Black Sox scandal, contradicts a lot of what we grew up reading in Eight Men Out or watching the film.
You know, one of the things, and by the way, on the Sabre website, there's a wonderful collection of the what you call the eight myths about the scandal. And one of them is fascinating. Well, they're all fascinating, but one of them in particular is that there's a myth that gamblers initiated this fix. Now, not to say they didn't take part in it, but your point is that this was actually led by Chick Gandel and Eddie Seacott. The players themselves actually approached the gamblers with the idea rather than the other way around, huh?
That's right. Yeah, this is, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions about the Black Sox scandal is that the players were kind of these, you know, undereducated, lowly paid players. They were mistreated by their owner, Charles Comiskey. All of these things are myths. And the idea that the players were kind of conned into throwing the World Series, that these, you know, these big city New York gamblers approached them and offered them a bribe to do this, you know, it really doesn't hold up to scrutiny anymore. And we know now that Eddie Seacott and Chick Gandel were the two players that really instigated the fix, and they were the ones that approached the gamblers with the idea to throw the World Series. And so That's, you know, just one of the many misconceptions that a lot of people still have about the 1919 World Series. And this year we've tried to shine a light on a lot of those myths and kind of debunk a lot of the old stories that are no longer considered to be factual.
Yeah, well, you know, going hand in hand with that myth is the one about Charles Comiskey, and that he was paying his players very poorly and mistreated them and was this miserly owner. But what, talk about the facts about that.
So, you know, we were able to get access about 15 years or so ago. We were able to get access to salary information about the 1919 season, and we were able to compare the White Sox player salaries to their peers across the American League and across all of baseball. And, you know, what we found out was that the White Sox were actually one of the best paid teams in baseball. And this totally contradicts the kind of the, what we call the central thesis of Eight Men Out, which is that, you know, Charles Comiskey was paying his players like the worst team in baseball. And this is said to be their motivation for why they fixed the World Series. It's because their salaries were so low and they were getting so poorly treated. They, Comiskey was said to have reneged on some bonuses due to the players. And so, you know, what we know now is that none of that was true at all. The White Sox were actually one of the highest paid teams in baseball. And Eddie Seacott alone was the second highest paid pitcher in baseball behind Walter Johnson, the great Hall of Famer. And so, you know, this idea that this is the reason why the players threw the World Series, because of their terrible salaries. You know, you do have to remember that this was under the reserve clause system. And so, you know, no player was making as much as maybe he would have made on the free market.
Right.
But the White Sox were, you know, comparatively in baseball, the White Sox were one of the best paid teams in baseball. And so, you know, if they did feel resentment at their salaries under the reserve clause system, well, so did players from every other team in baseball.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but none of them threw the World Series. So we have to look a little bit deeper into, you know, why they might have thrown the World Series. And the salaries really did not have much to do with it. And the players did not claim that that had much to do with it.
Yeah. You know, and the irony is that I think your data shows that they were paid some 15% more than the Cincinnati Reds, who they opposed in that World Series. It's kind of interesting. You know, another one is this myth around the Seacott bonus. Talk a little bit about what the myth is and then what the facts are.
Yeah, you know, this was one of the most dramatic scenes in the Eight Men Out film, was Eddie Seacott going up to Charles Comiskey's office and, you know, trying to get this bonus that he had supposedly earned if he would have won 30 games that season. And he finished the season with 29 wins in 1919. And so the myth is that Comiskey had ordered the manager to bench his star pitcher in order to avoid paying out this bonus. And the bonus was said to be $10,000, which was, you know, higher than Seacott's annual salary. I don't know too many people that get bonuses that are higher than their annual salaries, but certainly no one in baseball did in 1919 or probably any other time. But so this is the myth that Seacott was, you know, the bonus was not paid out to Eddie Seacott, and that this angered him so much that he, you know, got into the fix immediately afterwards. But again, we have access to Eddie Seacott's contracts. You can go to the Chicago History Museum and see exactly how much he was paid and exactly what bonuses he did get, because he did get some performance bonuses. He got a signing bonus in 1918 when he signed his contract. And so we do know exactly what he was paid. And the idea that Charles Comiskey would have promised him a bonus that was higher than his annual salary doesn't really pass the smell test. And also, you know, we know from retro sheet and looking at the box scores and the game logs that Eddie Seacott did have a chance to win his 30th game. This was the game where the White Sox clinched the American League pennant in 1919. But Seacott gave up 5 runs in 7 innings, and he was pulled in the 7th. And the White Sox rallied to win the game in the 9th inning on a walk-off single by shoeless Joe Jackson. So Seacott, if he had pitched better, he would have won his 30th game anyway. But, you know, but the idea that, you know, this was the reason that he entered the fix, again, none of it holds up to scrutiny, not the salary, not the bonus, and not the fact that, you know, he could have won his 30th game no matter what.
Yeah. And, you know, for perspective, you say on the website that Lefty Williams was paid a $500 bonus for winning 20 games. Now, it would be hard to believe that somebody would get 20 times more of a bonus for winning 30 games versus what he would get for winning 20. And even if Seacott was the star versus Lefty, it still doesn't add up. It's not the right order of magnitude. Perhaps, I don't know, perhaps this was concocted by Seacott to justify some of the actions that he was taking in this whole process?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of how these myths sprung up is because, you know, these were theories that were thrown out by their defense lawyers during some of the legal proceedings, the criminal trial, the grand jury testimony. Some of these ideas were thrown out by their defense lawyers. And so these were, you know, they were just kind of throwing out whatever might stick in the jury's minds. And so this idea that Charles Comiskey was this kind of Scrooge character, who didn't pay his players well, this was just one of their many theories that they tried to plant in the jury's minds. And some of them were successful and some of them were not. And this one just happened to stick, this idea that, you know, he paid his players so poorly and that he promised bonuses that weren't given out. And so I think, you know, it's hard to know what theories are going to stick in people's minds afterwards, especially, yeah, you know, 100 years afterwards. But this is one that has stuck, and it has stuck in part because it was included in Eight Men Out, both the book and the film. And, you know, so we have these dramatic scenes, you know, from Hollywood that stick in your minds. And so, you think, and it's all plausible, you know, it's all, we all wonder why these guys, you know, threw away their major league careers, you know, some of them in the prime of their careers, to fix the World Series. That's something that seems almost unfathomable, to most of us. And, you know, so there must be a good reason, right? And, yeah, we don't want to look at the easy reasons, like, you know, possibly just greed. So we try to come up with ideas for why they would have done this. And the idea that, you know, you would have been so mad at this terrible boss, who wasn't paying you what you were worth and then was denying you this bonus that he had promised. I mean, that makes sense to a lot of people.
That's
think
right.
People want to believe that type of myth.
Yeah.
But the facts really don't hold up there.
You know, another interesting one myth is that, you know, this was really this is looked at by many as this single isolated stain on the sport and on professional sports. But the reality is this conduct was actually somewhat representative of the era at that time. Right. Look at Hal Chase just a year before. And what he was caught doing in terms of bribing teammates, bribing opponents, and so forth. There was an integrity issue in the game back in the early 20th century, at least in this era.
You know, baseball had so many opportunities to clean up the game from all of the gambling, all of the betting, all of the game fixing that was going on in the early 20th century. And Hal Chase is kind of held up as the poster child of all that, and he was, you know, considered the most corrupt player in baseball history for all of his shenanigans. But baseball had so many opportunities to clean up the game, and they always turned a blind eye, and they turned a blind eye in the name of profits. And attendance was terrific up until the World War One years. Attendance was great, and baseball was extremely popular in the early 20th century, and this is kind of the era when it really became the national pastime in many ways. And so, yeah, they kind of turned a blind eye to all of the problems that were going on and under the surface. And gambling and game fixing were a huge problem for many years. And, so the idea that the Black Sox scandal was kind of this aberration, this isolated incident, really, you know, again, this is something that I think baseball wants you to believe, that if they just point the fingers at the eight men out and say, oh, these guys were terrible, they were crooks. They were corrupt, and this, you know, once we got rid of them, then everything was better. That's kind of laughable on its face, because the reality is game fixing was rampant during this era, and baseball had a lot of opportunities to clean this up before the 1919 World Series. And, you know, the White Sox kind of went into that World Series thinking that nobody would take this seriously if they threw the games, because nobody had ever taken it seriously before. There was an incident between Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker, two Hall of Famers, who fixed the game 1 week before the 1919 World Series. Nothing happened to them. Later, when it finally came out, they were given kind of slaps on the wrist, but they were allowed to continue playing baseball. But they fixed the game right before the 1919 World Series. This is something that was very casual for all of them. You know, you're just going to make a little bit of extra money and move on. And nothing was ever going to happen to them. So I think they saw, a pretty high reward and pretty low risk for fixing the World Series. They could not consider that baseball would ever take it seriously because baseball had never taken this seriously.
Yeah. And, you know, to that point, you mentioned here in one of the myths, the baseball's cover-up, that as early as the first game of the 1919 World Series, and perhaps even earlier than that, Charles Comiskey and others learned about this possibility of the fix, but really never did anything to address it. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, the World Series fix was kind of the worst kept secret in baseball in many ways. This was something that, you know, just about everybody in the game knew what was going on or had suspicions or had heard rumors about it. Again, this was something that just kind of happened in baseball. This was not an isolated incident that nobody had ever, conceived might happen before. And there were rumors almost every single year about the World Series being fixed. Now, some of that was just, disgruntled fans or possibly disgruntled gamblers losing money. But there were rumors just about every year. And where there's so much smoke, there might have been some fire in some of those earlier World Series. But in 1919, we finally found out because the players confessed that they had fixed the World Series. But, the idea that, Buck Weaver is kind of held up as the lone figure in the Black Sox scandal, he didn't take the money. He's the one player who did not accept any money from the gamblers. And he was still banned for life. And the reason he was banned for life is because he had this guilty knowledge. He did attend the meetings where the fix was being discussed, and then he didn't report it to his team. But the problem, of course, is that everyone on his team already kind of knew. His manager knew, his owner knew, everybody in White Sox management had already heard. They already knew enough to take any action if they had wanted to, but they really didn't want to because no one in baseball had ever taken much action against game fixing. And so they certainly weren't about to now.
And what about this notion of being shamed into silence about the Red Sox, the Reds and White Sox players being very reluctant to talk about the World Series. And yet there's over 100 interviews that have been discovered involving participants of the series.
This is one of those myths that thanks to the internet, we've been able to kind of uncover in the last, 10 or 20 years or so. This idea that the players involved in the 1919 World Series did not talk about it afterwards. They weren't interviewed. They weren't, they weren't open about it. Elliot Asenoff went looking for a lot of the surviving players, both the Black Sox and the clean players on the White Sox. And, he encountered this resistance. They wouldn't talk to him. He was one of the few writers that couldn't get them to talk. A lot of other writers did, were able to get interviews with these players, both the White Sox and the Reds. Thanks to the power of the internet and digitization of a lot of old newspapers, we've been able to discover over 125 interviews of players who participated in the World Series talking about the World Series and talking about the scandal. This idea that, these players, this was some isolated incident that these players didn't want to talk about and were very ashamed or embarrassed to talk about, doesn't really hold up. This was just, kind of something that happened to them. And, they obviously did wrong. But this was just, one of those things that happened in baseball. This was part of a larger culture of gambling and permissiveness involved in kind of, fixing games. And so, this idea that they didn't want to talk about it or they were shamed or they were afraid of, retribution from the gamblers all these years later. Again, it passes the smell test. It's something that, sounds plausible that these guys would be so scared of, the Al Capones of the world, the Arnold Rothsteins of the world. Certainly those gangland figures used violence, to keep people quiet. But the idea that these players never talked about the World Series afterwards really doesn't hold up anymore.
What's interesting about a lot of what you're talking about on these myths is Just because there's a rational basis for something doesn't have really necessarily any link to the fact that that something is the truth. You know, this is a situation where people had different motivations. And yes, you can create, you know, some rational story around it, including, you know, why would they throw their careers away? Well, the opportunity cost of what you were making as a professional ball player wasn't that much greater than what you could have made in your, in, you know, in your other jobs. I mean, perhaps it was a more glamorous life, although I'm not even sure that could even be argued. So it was different times. You know, today it would be crazy for someone to give up, you know, millions and millions of dollars for a foolish act like this, because it would be caught. But, you know, but back then that's not necessarily the case. What do you think will be the focus, or what do you expect the conversation and dialogue to be like next month in Chicago at the symposium? What are some of the focus areas of conversation?
Well, you know, I still think this year that we're focusing a lot on kind of the Eight Myths Out project that we published earlier this spring, and just, you know, opening people's eyes to the idea that, you know, what we all grew up reading in Eight Men Out, you know, isn't the full story, and that we've learned so much. I think this is still new to a lot of people. That we're still learning about the scandal. You know, I mean, people, you know, that aren't kind of as deep into the weeds of this story as say I am, you know, don't realize that, hey, we're still learning so much more, and there's still more out there. And, you know, people think that, oh, this happened 100 years ago. Surely we know everything there is to know about the Black Sox scandal. And, you know, they don't realize that all of this salary information came out, you know, in the 21st century, and all of the legal documents that are available at the Chicago History Museum, you know, are barely over 10 years old that we've had access to them. So, you know, we're still learning more. There's still more to be mined from all of this new evidence that has been uncovered in the last 10 or 20 years. And so, you know, we're still encouraging more people and more writers and more historians, you know, to go dig into those documents and see what they can find. I mean, we're still, you know, finding new articles about, you know, the players involved and the gamblers involved. That's another story that we've been uncovering, is finding out what happened with them and who was involved. I mean, it wasn't just Arnold Rothstein and his, you know, his henchman, Abe Attell, the boxing champion. You know, we've got evidence that, you know, there were probably four or five or six different gambling syndicates from all over the country that were involved in this scandal. So, you know, we're learning more about them. We're learning more about the money trail, follow the money, you know, and so that's, you know, we're still learning so much more about this as new evidence comes to light. And so I think that's something that, you know, unless you're really deep in the weeds with our Black Sox committee within Sabre, or, you know, you've been kind of doing your own primary research, I think a lot of people are still unaware that, you know, we're still learning so much more about this story.
Well, a real opportunity for fans and people interested, and people if they're in Chicago or even to come into Chicago for the Black Sox Scandal Centennial Symposium, the 27th of September through the 29th, with the focus really being the 28th at the Chicago History Museum. Go to the Sabre website, sabre.org. And registration is now open for that event, and really a really interesting slice of baseball history. Jacob, thanks so much for coming on today and for the great work you do for Sabre.
Thanks, Vince.